Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Quivers and the Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. Thank you. And this is an overview of results. I was thinking of how to present those things, and there were some requests to have a pedagogical presentation, but I felt that before pedagogical presentation, I should just give an overview which summarizes the results. And then once we are we're finished with this overview, we can concentrate or can discuss in more detail some of the technical aspects of those things and some of the methods of how to derive those results. So I'm going to present mainly results, and I also suggest open problems. And in order to, in the hope that this will initiate some discussion and some fruitful interaction between those who are interested to continue to look at this set of problems. Right. So I'll begin by just saying general words and mention the first example of a quiver and a Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and that is by taking n D3 brains in type 2B. And then there are two questions we can ask. First of all, what's the gauge theory that lives on the D brain? Which is well known. It's the n equals 4 U n gauge theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And on the other hand, there is a back reaction of the D brains on the geometry in such a way that the near horizon limit looks like type 2B on ADS 5 times S 5. And lots has been discussed about this correspondence. And the goal of this discussion over here is to try and extend it to other examples. And so up to now, for those of you who have been in the conference, in the workshop so far, most of the discussion was concentrating on keeping the topology of S5 the same, and dealing with some properties of deforming this S5 while keeping the same topology. And actually, we'll hear this week about the integrability structure of this theory. So I will not go in that direction. Instead, what we're going to do is to modify this S5 to something else. And we can do it in few perspectives. We can do it with the different motivations. And one motivation is to reduce the supersymmetry. And this is in the hope, the general words which are said when we reduce it to supersymmetry, is that so that it will fit something closer to the real world. So from n equals 4 n equals 2 and n equals 1. Another motivation is that when we will do such a thing, we will get chiral matter. This is something which does not exist in the n equals 4 theory and will exist generally when we discussed n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge theory. The third motivation that I can think of is that we will deal with conformal field theories in four dimensions. And we can ask ourselves, how many conformal field theories do we know in four dimensions? So the first one which comes to mind is the n equals 4 gauge theory. And then, I don't know, maybe we need to think a little bit more, think about n equal 2 theories, RGS Douglas points, the conformal window of n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge theories. And we would like to extend the knowledge about conformal field theories in four dimensions. Okay, so that will be another motivation. And actually, we will see an infinite class of theories which are conformal four dimensions, at least at the infrared, we are able to know about. No, you start with a UV theory, which sometimes even includes a UV irrelevant interactions. And when you flow to the infrared, because of supersymmetry, those terms which look irrelevant in the UV, they become exactly marginal in the infrared. And the statement is that at the infrared, you get non-trivial fixed points, conformal field theories.
But could it be that you get a non-conformal field theory?
You may get that, and that will be actually an interesting extension. That there's one traditional way of deforming a conformal field theory, but actually it will always be as a deformation, right? And the traditional way of deforming a conformal field theory is to add a relevant operator. This is something we can do, but in four dimensions it's not so natural because of the chirality. Because of the chirality, it is hard to generate operators which are relevant in the infrared. Instead, one way of deforming the supersymmetry, in deforming the conformality is to change the rank of the gauge groups. Since the beta functions depend on the rank, they will now generically be different than zero, and you'll have non-conformality. And this leads to a whole discussion about the duality cascades and thought geometries and so on. So I might mention this point towards the end. Any questions to what I said so far? Okay, so that's a motivation. We want to know more about conformal field theories in four dimensions, and we want to have in mind many examples, more than what we knew up to now. And the fourth point, maybe there are more. These are the things that I thought about. I welcome some thoughts from other people. The fourth point is that we want to get information, want to study string backgrounds using D-brain probes. And so here I'm using a fairly known idea. It's about 10 years old, this idea, D-brain as a probe. And what I want to do is to put a D-brain in space-time and study the gauge theory that lives on the D-brain. And from the properties of these gauge theories, I want to learn and to know more about the string background that this D-brain is probing. And we will actually have some results about this. Okay, so this is the motivation part. And so the first thing that I can do, the most obvious thing that I can do by varying the S5 to something else is to introduce an orbifold. And if we try to look at the ND brains in type 2B, the generalization to that is instead of taking R3,1 times R6, which is the case for flat space, what I'll do is to change this R6 to an orbifold, complex orbifold C3 mod gamma, where gamma, I want to keep supersymmetry, and therefore, if it is a subgroup, gamma is a discrete subgroup. And if it is a subgroup of SU2, there is an AD classification. Then we have n equal to supersymmetry. And if it is a subgroup of SU3, there will be n equal 1 supersymmetry. And here I can write down the set of theories that one can get. Let me write the list. There are 6 different types of groups. There is Z, the cyclic, and the cyclic squared. I denote it symbolically like that. And there is actually, it's convenient to think about the AD classification. There is an infinite set of A theories, infinite set of D theories, and 3 different exceptionals. For the SU3 subgroups, you just need to multiply this by 2. Right? So there are 2 infinite sets of abelian subgroups. There are 2 delta series, delta 6 and delta 3, 2 delta series. And there are 6 exceptionals, which is a curiosity. I don't know if anyone who studied in detail the exceptional groups, but at least the delta series were a subject of some phenomenological application. So that's an interesting point. And maybe we can add to those points over here that we may want to do some kind of phenomenology by placing D brains on singularities and try to see if it fits any of what we see in the observable world. And there were a few attempts to do that. I can mention work of Bernstein, Jajala, and Lee, Mariano Grania, and recently Verlinde and Weinhold. Okay. What is the ADS side? The ADS side, instead of S5, we will have S5 mod gamma. This was initially suggested in the context of ADS CFT. Very early on in the game, Eva is sitting here. Shamit and Eva did some work on this. And
a week later, is that recall?
Something like that.
A week after what?
After one paper? Wasn't it really fast? That's what I recall.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Actually, I think it was a few days after Ed's paper.
Oh, yeah, that may be whatever.
Everyone ignored Juan's paper until Ed wrote his paper.
That's the way of the world.
Okay. Now, One of the reasons I mentioned the orbifold, this is supposed to be a well-known story, but and in fact, the point is that so far, very little was learned beyond what is known for ADS5 times S5. The anomalous dimensions are the same, correlation functions are the same, at least in the part that we are interested in, and there was very little which was new. So people considered that as kind of boring. But I'd like to point out that recently in a work that I did with Chris Kennaway, we found some new information that one can extract from the for those orbifold theories. This is in terms of the multiplicities of linear sigma model fields. Needed to describe the orbifold. And for those of you who don't know what is the linear sigma model description, or maybe have a vague idea, it will take some time to introduce the concept. I just want to report that there is a very nice, beautiful combinatorial structure of getting numbers that are related to those orbifolds, and it's worth thinking about those numbers. So it will be part of the open problems. And if there will be any volunteer, it will be nice to give a more detailed discussion about those multiplicities. So maybe I'll do open problems over here. Multiplicities of toric diagram. And those numbers are, I think, they are interesting from a mathematical point of view, and I asked David what is the meaning. I asked a few other mathematicians what is the meaning, what is the geometric meaning of those numbers, and I guess that the answers are still not satisfactory. And from a physical point of view, the best I can say is this statement that I said over here. Those are multiplicities of linear sigma model fields which are needed to describe the Calabi-Yau manifold. And maybe there is a more intuitive notion of those multiplicities. Any questions?
So that's just for a single brain, right?
Yeah, for a single brain, for more I don't know if one can define the problem carefully.
I thought he was talking about the world sheet writing linear gauge linear sigma model, which renormalizes to the conformal filter.
That's right. Only for a single brain.
But look, that has nothing to do with the brain. That's the closed train sector.
It's the linear sigma model description of the D-brain.
Oh, the D-brain probe.
You get those numbers, for example, when you do when you try to.
It's a linear sigma model in higher dimensions.
That's
not a two-dimensional gauge linear.
That's correct.
You can also do it in two dimensions. I mean, it doesn't have to be.
But it's been used to describe the D3 brain.
I will soon talk about dimers. The way we did it with Chris was to use dimers in order to compute those numbers. And there is a beautiful connection with dimers. So once we will see the connection between dimers and quiver gauge theories, there might be some more understanding of how those things arise. We have to introduce the notion of perfect matching and so on. Now, in regards to these multiplicities, I would like also to mention a work by Muto, which is very recent. And he introduced an Ising model to compute those numbers. Which is kind of interesting. It brings some kind of ideas from condensed matter physics into this topic of quiver gauge theories. John Schwartz was asking me last week, what do dimers have to do with the string theory? So here's the answer. Okay. Sorry?
What are dimers?
The way we think of this in this context is just you take a two-dimensional lattice, any lattice that you want, and a dimer would be an edge which connects two points. Right? So you think of it as two molecules connected by some bond. Okay. And I don't have the time to do the details, but that's something that we may want to hear about in detail. But they are very useful in studying those quiver gauge theories. That's what it turned to be. Okay, so these are the words that I want to say about orbifolds. Let's proceed beyond orbifolds, beyond S5, beyond orbifolds, and the next simplest example, if we restrict to n equal 1 supersymmetry, we want a non-orbifold model. And the simplest one we can come up with is where we take, instead of C3 mod gamma, C3 or C3 mod gamma now will become a non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold. Restricting it to be a Calabi-Yau manifold ensures that this is n equal 1 supersymmetric. And if it is, and we also require it to be non-compact because we want to have a background which is ADS5. Right? So what we are doing is we take this Calabi-Yau to be of the form of a cone, where the metric on this Calabi-Yau is equal to dr squared plus r squared ds squared over a manifold, a 5 manifold, let's call it y. We take this coordinate r, combine it with the background generated by the three brains to form an ADS5, and what we are left with is this 5 manifold y5, and if we want the 6 manifold to be a Calabi-Yau, then the 5 manifold turns out to be a Sasaki-Einstein manifold. Einstein means that the curvature is rich curvature is proportional to the metric with a constant of proportionality which is positive. And Sasaki means that there is a covariantly constant spinor, meaning that the theories that we discuss are supersymmetric.
Can you kind of generalize this to a situation where there's also flux in the background?
I think, well, I know better how to do it when you think of it in terms of the gauge theory. And then in terms of the gauge theory, what you do is to vary certain terms in the superpotential. You vary coefficients of the superpotential. For example, a beta deformation can be thought of in this way. It's quite hard to find the explicit solutions to deform the metric solution and to turn on backgrounds and to still make it a solution.
Right, but there might be some generalization of that statement that it's about the other line to some generalized.
I mean, there is flux in this background. There's flux.
Once you have the frames, there's flux.
Right.
I'm saying if the background itself has flux efficient electrons, and then you put a little free mass, this is something that comes up.
Yeah, I.
Right there. But examples where you get things conformal to this, the kinds of things that, you know, people look at and. Could you get a metric that is conformal to the Clapeyron metric if you turn on?
I guess she wants some kind of a generic condition, which would be.
We're looking at a very restricted classical object because we're insisting on this cone structure so that we get a real ABS5 in the bulk. And I think you'd be hard pressed to put flux in that situation, in other than just the flux that comes from the brain.
Right, this question is partly coming from one dimension down. We think we have ABS4 times Calabia with flux.
Right.
So can it ever be true that that Calabia with flux plays a role in the phase here?
If you want this, if you want still to be with an ABS5, then from the point of view of the gauge theory, it means that you are actually moving on a conformal manifold. You are changing the theory such that you still keep a conformal invariance, right? You turn on fluxes such that you still keep on conformal invariance, meaning that you want the dilaton to stay fixed. You don't want to touch the dilaton. The dilaton is related to some of the gauge couplings there. There are such deformations, but I'm not sure if there is a general criterion. Anyhow. So we want to think about, now we want to think in general about Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. And the first non-orbifold model is the conifold. For which there has been a lot of study, I guess the order of 500 papers were written on the conifold theory. The cone there, what replaces the Sasaki-Einstein manifold is T11. And the quiver gauge theory is known. This was found by Klebanov and Witten. And let me do it. Let me write it down, the quiver gauge theory. And by this, I will raise some question which will be relevant later. So here's the quiver gauge theory. There are two gauge groups, UN cos UN. N is the number of brains, and there are two bifundamental fields. And in addition, since this is an n equals 1 gauge theory, we have to specify also the superpotential. So if we give names to those fields A and B, AI, BI, the superpotential takes the form AI, BJ, AK, BL, with two epsilon contractions. Why epsilon contractions? Because there are two SU2s, two SU2 global symmetries, I and K and J and L. And whenever I write the superpotential in this way, it is understood that I'm summing over all gauge quantum numbers with a trace at the end as well. So that's one way of representing this gauge theory that lives on the deep brain sitting on a conic fold. But I want to introduce a new type of notation. And this notation will turn out to be very useful because it will encode the superpotential and the gauge theory data in one writing. So I want to rewrite this quiver in the following way. I want to kind of flatten this quiver such that at every arrow that I will draw, there will be only one such arrow. I don't want multiplicities. And I will also introduce some room for the superpotential. So, and I will call that the periodic quiver. So let's see how we do that. This is group number one, this is group number two. I'm going to draw the first arrow from group number one to group number two. And I will draw another arrow from group number one to group number two, like that. Okay? I will proceed by, now notice that I wrote group number two twice, but I'm going to count it only once. Okay, I'm going to construct a periodic array where nodes are repeated, but they are repeated in a certain periodic fashion. Next thing that I want to do is to introduce arrows for node number two, and I will do it like that. An arrow like that, and another arrow like that to node number one.
Before you added these two, the quiver was the same as the one down here?
Exactly the same, right? We have two nodes. So let me write, let's say this is node number one, and this is node number two, so two gauge groups. Thanks for pointing this out. I had to denote those numbers. So and I drew those four arrows that I do over there, but it's in a kind of a weird fashion, right? And I'm going to repeat all of this.
So where are the A's and where are the
B's? So you can call this, here is AI. So this is A1, A2. It goes from, I'm sorry, this is B1, B2. And A1, A2 would be this. And I'm going to repeat this periodically. I'm going to put here node number two, and here again node number two. Here we will have node number one and one. And I'm going to redraw all of this continuously. The arrows would go from 1 to 2 over here, and from 2 to 1. Let me see.
Could you say why?
Sorry?
Could you say why you're doing this?
So why am I doing this? Because when I do such a thing, I will get a repeated structure of arrows that go in faces in an oriented fashion. Right? I have this face over here, and this face over here. And my claim is that I'm going to reproduce the superpotentials precisely as the sum of faces in the quiver. So the advantage that I have towards writing it in this way is that now faces in the periodic quiver will be precisely superpotential terms.
So there are other superpotential terms you could add that are not single strings. Would that correspond to some?
Yeah, it will correspond to some deformation of the Calabi-Yau manifold with some fluxes or some change in the geometry. And I want to keep the situation with the most singular Calabi-Yau and without changing the terms in the superpotential. Actually, I'm going to take the coefficients in the superpotential to be just like this, plus one or minus one.
Is that the same as in the original quiver if you had drawn that, you have an arrow with multiplicity two, you draw two arrows instead, it would just be closed loops on the quiver?
Yeah, a closed loop over here would be something like this going twice. But with such a closed loop, I need to specify which closed loop do I take, right? Because each time I go this way, right, I go from 2 to 1, I need to tell you which of those arrows do I choose. Right, there are many of them. Actually, there are 16.
I guess your point is that there are many closed loops, and this isolates the correct closed loop.
Precisely, right. And this isolates the right one, the right closed loops. Does this answer your question?
Well, it's a restriction on the possibility to reveal the result, which is fine. So I'm just curious what happens to the
I mean, the original Klebanov-Witten proposal, right, has the same status as the Malthusian proposal, that it's a proposed field theory dual for the geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're essentially giving a different combinatorial way to present the data, which includes the superpotential.
Yes, yeah. So at this point, it's just a different way of presenting the data. I'm just rewriting this superpotential in quiver. And what I'm doing it in one notation, right? One notation in which the nodes are gauge groups. The lines are matter fields, chiral multiplets, and the faces are superpotential terms. And I'm counting a superpotential term only once.
So do you get different terms from the different faces? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so let's do an example. Here, for example, we will have B1, A1, this will be B2 and A2. And here, this will be B1, A2, A1, and B2, which is just as this one, and A1, which is just as this guy. And there are only two terms, right? This term will generate precisely the same term as this one. And so I can form a periodic array. This is now, you can think of it as being on a torus. And we can now use Euler's condition. So Euler's condition says that on a torus, the number of nodes minus the number of edges plus the number of faces is equal to zero on a torus. What does this mean in terms of the gauge theory? It says that the number of gauge groups.
So the torus you have in mind is the one whose fundamental domain is on the board.
That's right. Yeah, this is not really the fundamental domain. This is twice the fundamental domain, right? And actually, you know, we need the fundamental domain should have two points only, two faces, or two parts of faces, right, such that it will contain two faces, and four fields, four edges. So the number of gauge groups minus the number of matter fields plus the number of superpotential terms is equal to zero. Let me erase this part here.
Why does it have to be a torus as opposed to a higher unit?
It turns out that this will be equivalent to a condition for conformal invariance of those Cleaver gauge theories.
So you could write down something that's higher genus than
but then you will lose conformal invariance
right.
When you will require that the beta functions, all beta functions of gauge groups and all beta functions of the coefficients of the terms in the superpotential, you'll require them to vanish. You'll find that this requirement is equivalent to requiring this condition of Euler. So I can write that this is equivalent to conformal invariance or to vanishing beta function. Beta functions NSVZ and superpotential or Yukawa's.
Wait a minute, you do higher genus for the
you can set it in such a way that, let's say, all gauge groups have zero beta function except for one of them, which has to accommodate for this non-zero right-hand side.
I'm just wondering what the sign is.
Oh, whether it's this I'm not sure. One amusing theory to study is the theory that you put on a cube.
There are a lot more non-renormalizable theories than
normalizable
theories.
Right, so
you're
guessing
maybe. Look, how much material?
We will, you know, I don't want to
we're
be.
We're bumping up against the blackboard.
Yeah. So let's.
People barely have enough time to go to the USN and get something. So what we could do is we could just people can be tough and. Go directly from here to the next seminar,
no.
Or we could read. I think the 2 o'clock slot is open.
depending on people's.
The report slot at 12 or
12:15.
Well,
you don't really seem to have come to a punchline.
No. I mean, I can just now finish with the introduction of tilings.
Or we could continue. You have another talk on Friday, right?
I can do that as well.
Okay. That might be the right thing
to do. Okay. So let me introduce. So we introduce the periodic weaver, and now let's do a duality transformation. Let's replace nodes by faces. Replace line by orthogonal lines and replace faces by nodes. So this quiver will get the form of a square. We'll have a square lattice like that. And now groups, gauge groups, are corresponding to faces. And so we can write 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay. Gauge group will correspond to faces. Edges will correspond to chiral multiplex. And now the chiral multiplex will be arrows that go perpendicular to those lines. So we will have the 1 to 2, right? So it will be arrows which go like that. Maybe we have a colored chalk. I don't see. So we'll do it with white. We will have 1 to 2, 2 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 1, and so on.
You're doing an alternate type of diagram now?
Yeah, and so the rule that we will have is that if we go along a given face, the arrows will go in an alternating fashion such that one is, you choose the first. That's by convention. You say it's outgoing, then the next one will be incoming, outgoing, incoming, and so on. And an interesting property that we see is that nodes now come in two different types. The arrows around the node are either clockwise or counterclockwise. Here's a counterclockwise node, and here's a clockwise node, and you can convince yourself that they will be alternating, that all of the neighbors of counterclockwise nodes will be clockwise nodes and vice versa. No nodes of the same type can be neighbors. You could also do this here. I mean, it's just those two descriptions are equivalent. This we call the periodic weaver. This we call the tiling model. Well, now tiles are gauge groups. We just tile the two-dimensional plane periodically with tiles of different type. And we make the rule that gauge groups are tiles. Edges are bifundamental fields, bifundamental chiral multiplet. And nodes are superpotential terms. And we can count.
Yeah, I think what you should do is you should give somebody a one or two sentence abstract for the next talk on Friday.
Okay, and finish.
Yeah.
Okay. So we arrived at the tiling model, and now we have a prescription, right? Think of any your favorite tiling of the two-dimensional plane. It should be made of faces which have even number of sides, right? It should be squares, hexagons, octagons, and so on. It cannot be pentagons, because pentagons will violate the rule of alternating arrows. When we go around, we won't close. Okay? Think of your favorite tiling of the two-dimensional plane, and that will define for you a quiver gauge theory for which there is a Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and for which there is a corresponding Calabi-Yau, and for which there is a corresponding conformal field theory. Very general construction. So what we can do next time is to start with where we stop over here and develop this this theory further.
Do you know these Sasaki-Einstein corresponding?
Yeah, we know how to compute those Sasaki-Einstein manifolds using methods in toric geometry.
Are there Sasaki-Einstein manifolds that don't have
tiling? There will be Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. We are restricting to toric singularities. It wasn't said in what I said so far, but those are toric singularities, and therefore singularities of the type, let's say, even n equal 2 theories with d-type singularities, I don't know how to describe them. Right? So it only restricts to singularities that admit toric description, and actually it's a nice open problem to figure out how to do it for non-toric. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.